ISIS and their most wanted today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Four friends from the Syrian city of Raqqa decided to defy ISIS, and ISIS made one of them pay a heavy price.
They gave him this choice, which was just a horrific dilemma. Do you choose your dad or do you choose your friends?
Plus, the man who started an online campaign to keep fellow Somalis from making the expensive and often deadly journey to Europe.
I would prefer to die in my home country than to be washed away by the Mediterranean Sea.
And at a pastry shop in Lisbon, a recipe so secret, so delicious, that the three bakers never fly together.
Not because we're afraid of that the plane crashes, it's because we need someone here because we never close.
The stories plus 30 years after Chernobyl, today on The World. Glad you could join us today. The phrase most wanted, usually that makes us think of bad people doing bad things. The FBI's most wanted list includes murderers and drug dealers. Bad guys also have their most wanted, though, and that's where we're going to start the show today. My partner at the BBC, Chloe Hajimateu, has a new radio documentary called Islamic State's Most Wanted. It's about four young men from the Syrian town of Raqqa, often referred to as the capital of ISIS. But these four men dared to defy ISIS when the militant group took control of Raqqa. And Chloe Hajimateu says one of them, a man named Hamoud, was the crazy driving force of the foursome.
He was quite manic. He was a real personality, according to them. Extremely funny, charismatic, speaking all the time, jumping all over the place. He was really one of the driving forces behind the protests during the Arab Spring in Syria. He was instrumental in mobilizing loads of the protests that took place in Raqqa. A real big personality, was not intimidated by any kind of authority.
Right. When the democracy protest started, that was 2011, ISIS doesn't get to Raqqa kind of till about 2014, takes over the town. They impose their dress code. They ban alcohol, cigarettes, even music. And then Hamoud and his friends come together. They start this graffiti campaign. But Hamoud seems most comfortable online, not doing graffiti on walls. What did he actually do online?
He's kind of a weird combination between fearless activist and dweeby nerd who just sits and spends loads of his time online. He, right back from when he was in high school, apparently, he hacked into the Syrian state's computers and got exam results for his fellow high school students and published them before the Syrian government had a chance to do so. And these young men were protesting at first anonymously, and they became citizen journalists, in effect, because nobody was covering what was going on in their city. And they felt that these were historic times. They began to record and video and photograph what was going on and upload this material onto social media. And Hamoud was one of the leading guys doing this under a false name in the beginning. Once Raqqa was liberated from the regime, or once the Syrian government lost control of Raqqa and a whole medley of groups took over, they felt that there was a certain amount of freedoms. So they started using their names online. International media began picking up their material. By the time Islamic State took over, there was a very obvious massive clampdown on activists and citizen journalists. And Hamoud and the other members of his group who were known, publicly known, who'd used their names, were forced to flee the city. But they wanted to carry on what they were doing, their work, their citizen journalism. So they moved across the border to Turkey and they began managing a group of journalists who weren't known, who were working undercover, in effect, within the city of Raqqa.
Yeah,
it was much
easier
for them.
It's pretty dicey, isn't it? And there's one moment where somebody's videotaping on a cell phone and almost gets caught by ISIS. It's really, really harrowing.
It's very dangerous what they're doing, but they lost somebody quite early on. One of their founding members was caught by ISIS going through a checkpoint with a laptop full of incriminating evidence, and he was executed. And it came as a massive blow to the group, and they started taking huge measures to cover themselves. So Hussam, one of the main men in the group, was filming an execution in Raqqa, and an ISIS guy came up to him and said, "What are you doing? Let me see your phone." Very luckily, they have very clever ways of hiding everything they do behind sort of different kind of walls within their mobile phones. So it's impossible to access unless you have very specific passcodes. So all this ISIS man could see were photos of al-Baghdadi, the ISIS leader, and other jihadist songs and speeches. And so he got away with it. But it was pretty hairy.
So as you say, Hamoud and his friends, they flee to Turkey. Then ISIS kidnaps Hamoud's father back in Raqqa, and they release a video showing his dad and other captives dressed in orange jumpsuits in a dark room. There's a light that shines on their faces, as you explain, as they make their forced confessions. And I want listeners to hear a clip of that moment from your documentary. The voice you hear is Hamoud's kidnapped father.
أنا والد المدعو حمود محمد الموسى طبعا ابني حمود موجود بتركيا.
And then the scene changes. It's nighttime in the forest. The men are all tied to trees with rope. Then their executioners appear.
All right, I'm not going to play the next bit. It is just so painful to hear those men being shot. Hamoud's father is not immediately killed, and it's just incredible when you get back to kind of the circle of friends, how Hamoud's friends try and protect him from learning what happens to his dad on the laptop. Here's Abdulaziz, one of Hamoud's colleagues, in a clip from your doc, Chloe.
We saw the video together. When we arrived to the moment when they want to kill him, I closed the laptop. I didn't let him complete. All of us started to cry.
Yeah, really, really intense. So Hamoud ultimately does watch the video through to the end to see how ISIS kills his father. And to an extent, his friends are able to help him get through that moment. They're all today hiding out in capitals throughout Europe. I know ISIS hasn't stopped hunting them, but then they have a wedding for Hamoud. How did they deal with that? What sort of security precautions did that entail?
They wanted to have the wedding for Hamoud, really, to try and lift his spirits, but also to try and protect him and root him in Turkey, because Hamoud was so distressed about the death of his father. And I should point out that the reason that ISIS kidnapped his father was to blackmail Hamoud. They took his father and his friends and said, unless you give up some of your undercover operatives working in Raqqa, we're going to execute your father. So in a sense, they gave him this choice, which was just a horrific dilemma. Do you choose your dad or do you choose your friends? And when they executed his father, he was very distressed and was threatening to go back to Raqqa to take revenge. So his friends decided to organize a wedding for him. He was already engaged, and they were hoping that by doing that, they would lift his spirits, but also hope that his wife would kind of watch over him and prevent him going back to Raqqa. It was incredibly dangerous. Most of the guests at the wedding were activists in some form or another. So the arrangements for the wedding were all done in secret, and the guests weren't told about the location of the wedding until a few hours before the event.
We know from Paris and Brussels how deep into Europe the ISIS tentacles go. Were you surprised, though, that they would hunt these guys down in Europe?
I think what was really shocking was the reach that ISIS has within Turkey. I should say one of the most harrowing moments that these young men experienced was when somebody that they knew vaguely from back home in Raqqa arrived in Turkey and said he'd escaped from ISIS and needed help resettling. He befriended the group for 2 months and then executed two activists, one member of the group and another guy, in the middle of the night. And he had been an ISIS operative working undercover for 2 months.
Wow.
Which is really terrifying.
They're still training undercover reporters inside Syria and Iraq, as you explain in the doc. Hamoud is expecting his first child. But in the end, he's gone from kind of a happy-go-lucky guy to this very reserved and dark person, despite his wedding, the baby on the way, all that. Do you worry about him, Chloe?
I do worry about him. I worry about all the group, in fact. And they were young men who were very brave and possibly a little bit naive when they first started doing what they do. And once the murders began, I think they felt so roped in to what they're doing that there's no turning back. Too much blood has been spilt for them to ever go back to their previous lives. And they know that they may have to spend the rest of their lives in hiding.
The BBC's Chloe Hajimateu has released a new radio documentary called Islamic State's Most Wanted. Chloe, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
We'll also be hearing today from someone else who wound up in big danger in Syria. My interview with former hostage Theo Padnos coming up in the second half of the show here on The World. I want to return now to something I mentioned in yesterday's show, the passing of African pop star Papa Wemba, a.k.a. the King of Congolese Rumba. The 66-year-old was an exceptional singer from Democratic Republic of Congo, but in 2003, his life took an unfortunate turn when he was arrested for trafficking in visas. And that's what we're going to look into next. First, though, a quick crash course in Papa Wemba before we get to what landed him in jail. He was born Jules Shungu Wembedio Pene Kikumba. His early crooner abilities had him add Presley to that name.
Hey, 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 mama, oh. Olangui singa.
Papa Wemba sang with the influential dance band in Congo, Zaiko Langa Langa, a harmony-based group that really molded the sound of rumba congolese. It was through Zaiko Langa Langa that I first heard Papa Wemba. Their cassettes were everywhere across West Africa. A 1995 album, Emotion, introduced Papa Wemba to Western audiences to great acclaim. Then came that visa trafficking episode in 2003. Papa Wemba was part of a scheme to sell seats on his tour plane to Congolese trying to get to Europe. $3,500 a seat for as many as 200 migrants. The buyers would pose as members of his band, but they had no intention of returning to Congo. A few years ago, I asked Papa Wemba why he did what amounts to a form of human smuggling.
Je n'ai pas fait ça pour remplir mes poches, quoi. Vous savez, bon, le continent africain, les enfants.
I didn't do it to fill my pockets. You know, in Africa, African youth believe the honey still flows freely in the West, and their parents encourage their kids to go study in Europe and then return to Congo to serve their country. But since it's hard to get a visa, there's always small ways to get one.
That was from my interview with Papa Wemba in 2010. Today, I got in touch with Lubangi Munyanya. He is a Congolese arts educator and new Papa Wemba. Munyanya is based in New Jersey, and I asked him if he thought Papa Wemba had been a human smuggler.
That's not what he does. He was trying to help youth to escape the war.
Why did he accept to $3,500 per person then, if he was doing this out of kind of a humanitarian impulse?
From what I heard, it was mostly to pay the cost of people who were actually helping him in the French embassy or Belgian embassy to give them visas. So these people needed to get paid.
Yeah, but still, that puts him in a very tricky position where he's essentially turning into a human smuggler. I mean, there is an exchange of money and he'll get them to Europe, right?
How did people get out of Nazi Germany back then? In Congo, if you think of 6 million of people that died, and women who were raped, countless numbers of abuses. You know, the Congolese passport could not help you get out, cross the border, and then go to a neighboring country. So something had to be put in place to help people get out of the country. And Papa Wemba had a father's status to a generation that he helped sort of like create culturally. That's why they call him Papa, the father. So there were no institution, no NGO that was helping Congolese flee the country, flee the war.
You know, Lubangi, if we're to be totally honest about this, though, if we go back to World War II and the Kinder transport, I mean, that was also a form of human smuggling, wasn't it?
I mean, you could say that. But if the sole purpose of doing that was making money, then I'll say Papa Wemba did wrong. But the purpose of people leaving the country because it was a war, remember they called it the African World War.
Were you in Congo when all of this was happening in 2003?
No, I was, you know, likely I was outside of the Congo. But I was dealing with the same issues with my own family. People were trying to flee. Our lifestyle changed because we needed to send money to have them crossed to Tanzania, to Zambia, Angola. But sometimes they will capture them and send them back. Congo was occupied. 3,000 people were being killed, slaughtered every day.
Lubangi, how do you think that whole episode is going to color Papa Wemba's legacy?
Let me tell you, Papa Wemba is a hero in whatever he did. He did what he thought it was best for his fans, for his people. Get them out of trouble. He did what he had to do.
That was Lubangi Munyanya, a Congolese arts educator who grew up with African pop star Papa Wemba. Wemba died over the weekend while on stage performing in Ivory Coast. An effort to stop Somalis from taking the dangerous journey to Europe. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. This next story is not a happy one, but there is a bright spot. Hundreds of Somalis died last week in the Mediterranean. They were on boats trying to make it to Europe. In response, some young Somalis took action online. Abdinur Mohamed Ahmed is one of them. He lives in the Somali capital, Mogadishu.
And we decided to do something that could be a hashtag where we wanted to raise a public awareness on youth, because most of the people who emigrate to Europe nowadays are using on social media. And they are seeing beautiful pictures from Europe and America, and that will tell them that this is a better place to live and this is a better life.
I mean, the hashtag is called Don't Buy Death. Why would you say these migrants are actually buying death?
They are buying death because they are paying at least $10,000 to reach to Europe. There is a ring of smugglers who are taking the people from Mogadishu, from Hargeisa, and other parts of the country. They use, you know, different routes to reach to Libya or Egypt. And they are paying a lot of money. That money could be invested in the country and could be established as small businesses. And at the end of the day, some of them are going to die, are washed away by the Mediterranean Sea. So don't buy death. We mean that you have money, you have to spend your money in your own country.
Even if that country is in dire straits, I mean, don't a lot of these people have good reason to be leaving Somalia?
Marco, to be frank, I would prefer to die in my home country than to be washed away by the Mediterranean Sea.
I mean, in a lot of cases, these people are migrating for the benefit, not of themselves, but of their children. So their kids have some kind of an education when they get to Europe. And so their kids don't die in Somalia. I mean, what do you say to those parents?
Most of the people who are immigrating to Europe are youth. Somalia's population is estimated over 70% of the population is youth under the age of 30. So if all the youth decide to leave this country, if we lose, you know, scores of hundreds of talented human resources we had, so how this country will recover, how Somalia will stand on its feet, I really encourage our young people to stay in their country. And they have to take a driving seat. They have to try to contest the next elections in 2016. They have to spend their quality time with their families, and they have to try to reverse the situation on the ground.
Abdinur, you're a journalist, as I said, in Mogadishu. Why do you stay in Somalia? What is your kind of goal in staying?
I have a father of two kids. They were born in Islamabad, Pakistan, when I was a student over there. And then we moved to Somalia in 2013. But my wife rejected. She said to me that we can't live here. And I was saying that our children were born abroad. What about, you know, the future if we stay overseas all the time? So I understood that in order to make a good future for my kids, I have to spend more time trying to find out solutions of our problems rather than complaining. So that is why I am here. That is why I'm working in Somalia. And that is why I escaped for two times when Al-Shabaab attacked for the two different occasions. And I say thanks God, because I believe I have to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And I have to take my journalistic skills and my pen to save my country and make it a better place where my children and my grandchildren are going to stay for their whole life.
Abdinur Mohamed Ahmed is a journalist based in Mogadishu, the Somali capital. He's part of a group in charge of creating the Don't Buy Death hashtag. Abdinur, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much.
In Portugal, the area around Lisbon is known for round custard tarts called pastéis de nata. And one bakery in particular has a special claim to fame as the home of the original recipe created in the local monastery of Geronimo. The bakery, Pastéis de Belém, has operated in the same spot since 1837. And as Emma Jacobs reports, the recipe is still a closely guarded secret.
A decade ago, the owner of Pastéis de Belém sat Carlos Martins down and told him he could become one of the three chefs entrusted with the secret recipe for the pastéis de nata. Because one of the bakers, Henrique, he wanted to retire after 60 years on the job. And Martins, who'd worked here since he was 14, he was a good candidate for his replacement.
He told me I was one of the chosen ones to find out about the secret. I was very happy, of course.
So now every morning, Martins gets up and goes to work in a room behind a metal door marked secret. There, he and two other specially initiated bakers make enough dough and custard for 20,000 pastries a day. It's a big responsibility. The three can never travel together.
Not because we're afraid of that the plane crashes, it's because we need someone here because we never close.
Manuel Clorinha is the fifth generation of his family running Pastéis de Belém. He says the secret recipe originated in the massive stone monastery of Geronimos down the street. It was an important institution during the Portuguese Age of Discovery, when the monks prayed for sailors. Many Portuguese custard pastries originated in monasteries and convents because the monks and nuns had a lot of egg yolks.
They used the egg whites to start to press their starch, their cloth, and they were sort of left over with the yolks.
A businessman bought the recipe from Geronimo's monks and later sold it to Clarinha's family. They've been making pastéis de nata here ever since.
The recipe is not only emotional, it's also part of us, or part of this company's identity. So, of course, if someone else were to come here and say, I know the recipe, I would be like, oh no, okay, we have to hire you now or put you in a basement or something, I don't know.
After the three chefs combine the ingredients behind the metal door, the pastries get assembled by a large staff. The custard bubbles in a 750-degree oven. Once the pastries cool, they're served to customers from all over who line up outside the door. Besides Portuguese, you can hear French, German, Italian, Spanish, and English. Claire Coey has come from Scotland to visit friends who live nearby. She says she's even tried to make this type of pastry herself, but they hardly compare to what she's just eaten.
I tried it, but they were no use. I can't get this custard at all. This is just wonderful. This is one of the most important sites to visit.
And it's getting a lot more visitors these days. Tourism is up all over Lisbon, partly because of investments in the infrastructure for visitors, and because a lot of European tourists are avoiding other warm weather destinations.
Hopefully never will. Problems with violence and with terrorists or something like that. So I guess all that combined and all other things that are happening in the Mediterranean and North Africa and other typical tourist destinations made it possible for Portugal to welcome a lot more tourists.
As long as the tourists come to visit the monastery, there'll be plenty of demand for a pastry that has outlasted the monks who lived there. And in theory, it could even outlast the family that's run this bakery for so many generations.
I don't know if someday my cousin or my sons or my sons will pick up the business directly or not, but it has never been imposed. It's always been optional, so I guess for now I'm happy, and we'll see how it goes.
Clarinha jokes that Martin's the pastry chef. He's got 50 more years here, at least. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Lisbon.
Coming up, the changing face of a Boston immigrant neighborhood. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. 30 years ago in Chernobyl, Ukraine, a nuclear disaster spread radiation across the globe. And in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev,
the creepiest thing was that, you know, there were no children that summer. It was like the summer without children. Anybody who could got their children out one way or another.
Remembering Chernobyl, that's just ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. On this day, 30 years ago, the world suffered its worst peacetime nuclear disaster at the Soviet reactor in Chernobyl, Ukraine. A power surge during a routine test led to the rupture of a reactor vessel and a series of steam explosions. There was a massive leak of radiation, leading to fallout, eventually landing all over Europe. Dozens of people died in the struggle to contain the disaster. Hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated. And even now, three decades later, a large area remains contaminated and closed off to the public. We're going to hear two perspectives on this anniversary from both Russia and Ukraine. And we start with writer Natalia Antonova, who was a kid in Kiev, the Ukrainian capital, at the time of the accident. At first, Natalia, the Soviet authorities tried to suppress the news. When did your family find out what was actually going on?
From what I understand, and my grandfather is unfortunately not around anymore to really ask him, but from what I understand, we found out sooner than the general public, but later than a few other officials. My grandfather is a general in the Soviet Army. And as soon as he heard that this was happening, you know, they put me on a train to St. Petersburg with my mom, which I don't remember. I was two years old at the time. I do know from my mom's stories and from my dad's stories that a bunch of people didn't know. And even like as far when the May holidays actually started in the Soviet Union, all of these people were still not aware that something disastrous had happened.
So you're saying that because your grandfather was a general, he was kind of privy to insider information that this was going on before anybody else in Ukraine knew?
Yeah, he was not one of the first people to know, but I think the information reached him much quicker than, you know, the general public. That's why I was out so quickly.
Mm. So I know you were really young, but what do you recall of that time? Any kind of like sensory experience of the time?
All I remember, and I remember just, you know, I remember being in St. Petersburg and dancing with a bear. And for some reason, everybody being really sad, but I'm dancing with like, oh, it was a toy bear, not a real bear. But yeah, but I do know that I know my father's stories from that time because he stayed in Kiev.
Hmm.
And my father is actually, he's an engineer by trade. And it was really personal for him because, of course, when he was doing his interning, he had interned at Chernobyl. You know what I mean?
Wow.
So when it actually happened, he was, you know, not working there at all. But of course, it triggered a lot of emotions for him. And he really wanted to kind of at least stay in the city because he didn't feel like abandoning, you know, his home. And he didn't want to abandon the area in a time like this, even though, I mean, we were actually now we know that it was Belarus that got the worst of it. Kiev actually didn't. But yeah, still,
I was going to ask you, how much have you talked with your dad since then about his concerns about staying in Kiev?
He definitely had concerns. He told me the creepiest thing was that, you know, there were no children that summer. It was like the summer without children. And that really bothered him because anybody who could got their children out one way or another. And you know, he said it was really upsetting because you're coming home from work in the evenings and it's so quiet. And there's this tension in the air and nobody wants to talk about it, but nobody can ignore it. And I think it really left a mark, an impression on him for a long time.
Wow, what an image. Summer of no children.
Summer of no children, yeah.
So do you remember when you first became aware of what happened in Chernobyl?
Yeah, I remember it was – my mom was hospitalized a few months after it happened. I'm thinking maybe 6 months. I don't have the exact date, but it's around 6 months. And my mother was – she was in some kind of special ward. She had a thyroid problem and it was really out of control. And she said that some of the people on her ward were the people who were the first responders. And this, of course, really, really upset her. And as the result, you know, she began telling me stories. And then I started finding out about people who were sick from it. And, you know, not the people who died very quickly, but people who developed, you know, these exotic cancers and so on that, you know, medicine wasn't really prepared to deal with at a time. And I guess I just, you know, you gradually grow into this understanding that something terrible happened next door and is going to affect everybody. And I was also told, I mean, my parents were really honest with me. They said, we don't know how it's going to affect us. Maybe it is affecting us. Maybe it's not. We don't know. So I kind of had to also process that as a child.
Writer and journalist Natalia Antonova, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Russians were also directly impacted by Chernobyl. Ukraine was, after all, part of the Soviet Union. The explosion at Chernobyl Reactor 4 sent up a cloud of radioactive material that blew into parts of neighboring Russia and Belarus. And Moscow managed the crisis from the Kremlin. Vladimir Putin said today that the Chernobyl disaster was a grave lesson for all of mankind. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. Charles, 30 years on, how was that history commemorated, if at all?
Well, there was basically a memorial park here in Moscow. It's a cemetery where they had about 1,500 people gather, family members, some government officials. The Patriarch of Russia, Kirill, also showed up to pay a respect to the liquidators. These are the volunteers who helped clean up Chernobyl following the disaster. So, you know, there was a ceremony today, but as you noted, President Putin issued a statement. So it was not quite the same response that you might have seen, for example, in Kiev, where you had Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko really participate in an actual ceremony.
And those liquidators, they obviously got very sick from radiation poisoning. Does Russia today kind of see them as heroes, or was this kind of more of a pro forma memorial?
Well, I think certainly some people do, and certainly, you know, respect is paid to them. You know, there were 28 liquidators, for example, that were buried in this cemetery where the ceremony took place today. You have 16,000 liquidators in Moscow alone, and there are many more spread across the Soviet Union who took part in the cleanup. Essentially, these are the, you know, young men, and they were basically all young men who were sent in, often with no protective gear, with, you know, sort of cloth masks to go with a shovel and just clean up the mess that came out of Chernobyl.
I mean, it's kind of a grim word, depending on whether it's active or passive. I mean, if they're going in and liquidating the problem, then they're heroes. But I mean, if they're going in and they're getting liquidated, that's kind of sad.
It is. And that's, in fact, you know, I mean, if you look at those, there's sort of 30 that have, you know, died directly from radiation exposure from that period, 31, in fact. And the numbers are sometimes debated in terms of how many people have died since. But certainly the health needs of those people were significant in the years, and hundreds have died. So I think these people are certainly respected by many. On the other hand, the government, there was reports in the Russian press today that the government is cutting back on subsidies for some of these social programs that they provide these people. As sort of, it's been kind of an honorary thing that's continued after the fall of the Soviet Union. And so you see this kind of sort of back and forth in terms of what the response is to Chernobyl. I think it gets to this kind of strange sense that if you look at the 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster, Russia and Ukraine were kind of side by side. It was a real shared event. Now it's really a separate event. The Russian and Ukrainian relations are so bad these days, following the annexation of Crimea, following the war in East Ukraine and the Donbass region, that, you know, it just seems as though they're just completely separate events now.
How does that impact how Russians are remembering or choosing to remember this day?
If their family members were involved in this, of course, they remember this event. It's a very solemn one. But in terms of Soviet tragedies, and of course, Chernobyl is a Soviet tragedy, the sense you get is that Russia would kind of prefer this to be Ukraine's event. This is Ukraine's legacy.
So tonight on Russian television news, how high up will the Chernobyl anniversary play?
It's high. In fact, you know, you see them, you know, certainly devoting some time to the story of the liquidators and what happened back in 1986. But on the other hand, I think if you looked, for example, I just watched the Russian state news, and there was no mention of the events in Ukraine. So, for example, no coverage of Poroshenko's speech today, no coverage of the ceremony in Pripyat by the Chernobyl station. It was all focused on Moscow and Moscow's story.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Back in 2008, our reporter Jason Margolis actually went to Chernobyl. He went on a tour, and when he got back, a government official told him that the government doesn't let tourists go there. So his trip to Chernobyl didn't happen, at least officially. Whether it happened or not, we have photos from Jason's trip up on our Tumblr. Just head over to pritheworld.tumblr.com to check them out. All over the U.S., there are communities that have served as starting points for new immigrants for generations. One of those places is East Boston, just down the road from our studio. Over the years, East Boston has been a home for Irish, Russian, and Jewish newcomers to this country, and more recently, immigrants from Central and South America. But East Boston's tradition as an immigrant haven might be changing with rising housing costs, and that could spell the end for one unique community. Here's Rupa Shenoy of the Otherhood podcast with a story.
In an East Boston restaurant, people speak Spanish with a particular accent. It's from a small Colombian mountain town called Don Matias. Jorge Carballo's from the same region.
The first time that I came to East Boston, I stepped out of the car, and the first thing I heard, and I promise you, was people speaking from one side of the street to the other side of the street with the accent of my region. And I was like, oh my God, where am I?
Caraballo is a graduate student, and he's doing his master's on the unique way people from Don Matias recreated their community in East Boston. People now say there are more Don Matians here than in Colombia, and they feel at home because they're surrounded by their language, their food, their grocery stores, with the added benefit of more opportunities and higher pay. All this came about because of a string of events that started in the 1960s. Back then,
Don Matias was this little village with agricultural economy.
It was a quiet town centered around the local church. Then a priest devoted to a new, seemingly radical philosophy, liberation theology, helping the poor, was assigned to Don Matias. And the town became an unlikely front line in the Catholic Church's internal struggle. The priest organized poor farmers, angering the handful of rich families. They asked the church to remove the priest. The New York Times and Time magazine did stories when the priest refused to leave and instead set up his own services, school, and workers' cooperative.
International media looked at this little village battle as an example of the battles inside the church, where leftist priests, revolutionary priests, were standing with the poor.
Eventually, there was violence. A rich man was killed. Wealthy families fled the town, and Don Matias's economy died. People started relocating to Massachusetts, where they could find work. Moving to East Boston became a kind of coming-of-age tradition in Don Matias. And they're still coming, some without documentation, like Daniela. We're not using her full name. Daniela talks about coming here 3 years ago to be with her boyfriend and staying to work at a wire transfer business, bakery, and grocery store. Remittances from Don Matians in East Boston have rejuvenated their hometown. Daniela says family back home in Don Matias are constantly asking her to send name brand and designer stuff, sometimes because someone else on their street with a relative in East Boston has it. Unfortunately, money's tight here. Boston is one of the most expensive rental markets in the country. Daniela pays $650 a month to share a three-bedroom apartment, plus utilities and internet service. And she doesn't know how long she can afford to stay. Don Matias transplant Adrian Cadavid owns Cafe Gigu here. Jorge Caraballo translates this bit.
He's a leader, a community leader, and he thinks about this a lot because he says that this diversity, Latino diversity, is what makes this neighborhood nice and rich. So that's beginning to get lost.
Cadavid says there's only one way to combat gentrification. Wealthier Don Matians like him, who own businesses and homes, have to resist selling to developers who want to put up more luxury condo buildings that, in turn, drive poor Don Matians out. Otherwise, just as the original Don Matias is coming back to life, the East Boston Don Matias could be slipping away. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, East Boston.
A note now on a story of justice delayed, making big news in Britain today. A jury announced a verdict in what's known as the Hillsborough case. It was 27 years in the making, so let me back up here for a recap. On April 15th, 1989, soccer fans gathered at Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield, England. One of the teams playing was Liverpool FC. Some 10,000 Liverpool fans had tickets, but as kickoff time drew closer, it became clear there were not enough gates open to let everyone in on time. The police opened extra gates, causing a crowd to surge in. People were crushed. In the end, 96 Liverpool fans died. A police investigation blamed the fans for being unruly and possibly drunk, but the families never accepted that. They battled for years to get some justice, and a few years ago, an independent panel found evidence of a police cover-up. Officers in charge of crowd control that day had altered their reports to remove any suggestion they were at fault. A new investigation followed, and now a jury has finally concluded that it was not the fans who were at fault, but the police. The jury found that the victims were unlawfully killed and that police failures contributed to the disaster. The current head of the South Yorkshire Police, David Crompton, said as much after the verdict.
On the 15th of April, 1989, South Yorkshire Police got the policing of the FA Cup semi-final catastrophically wrong. The force failed the victims and failed their families. Today, I want to apologize unreservedly to the families and those affected.
It's a bittersweet victory for the families. Trevor Hicks's two teenage daughters, Sarah and Vicky, died in the disaster. Here's his message today for the authorities.
If they'd stepped up to the plate in the first place, back in 89, yes, we couldn't have stopped the disaster that had already happened. But we could have stopped this absolute disgrace of 27 years of putting through the families through agony. And, you know, it's took us all this long to get the justice that we've deserved.
After the verdict was announced, the families gathered outside the courtroom and sang the anthem every Liverpool fan knows by heart. You'll never walk alone. You're with The World. You may know Theo Padnos as the journalist who was held hostage by extremists in Syria for almost 2 years. His captors from the al-Qaeda affiliate al-Nusra Front released him in 2014. But Padnos is also a scholar of Islam and the author of a book about Islamic extremism. So when I spoke with him today, I asked him first for his reaction to the plan by the Obama administration to send an additional 250 U.S. Special Forces to Syria to help fight ISIS.
If they knew how widespread Islamic extremism is in that part of the world and how soaked into the culture it is, we wouldn't imagine that 250 people can help. We would think of other remedies.
Does that imply a belief on your part that the U.S. Should support Bashar al-Assad?
I certainly do think that, yes. I mean, I think that he is the most competent local authority and he's best positioned to bring the most peace the most quickly. And that's what the outside world wants.
I mean, that might be a practical view, but I mean, Bashar al-Assad's known for targeting civilians with barrel bombs and starvation. How can there ever be an end to this war if Assad himself isn't stopped?
I think that he can be persuaded to abandon the most evil of his tactics.
International actors have been trying to persuade him for over 5 years, and so far nothing.
We have had relatively little high-level attempts, at least on the American side, to come to terms with this government. We condemn him, we wag our finger at him, but we don't try to negotiate with him.
So there's Bashar al-Assad on one side, ISIS on the other side. There's also al-Nusra, an extremist group linked to al-Qaeda, that held you in pretty terrible conditions for 2 years. You were in a cell sometimes with members of ISIS. Do you really think there's much of a difference between groups we call extremists and these so-called moderate rebels or extremists who receive U.S. support?
Depending on the day of the week that you ask them the question, in order to determine the degree of extremism from one group to the next, you'd have to subject each fighter to like a Spanish Inquisition, and it's just not practical or feasible or useful.
I mean, this whole thing is not theoretical for you. You escaped from al-Nusra twice, sought refuge with the Free Syrian Army, only to have the Free Syrian Army send you back to your torturers.
Look, the issue there is I was a valuable prisoner, and so the people with the greatest physical power on the ground are entitled to control the valuable resources in the area.
Theo, do you think these young people are brainwashed and can they be unbrainwashed?
When they are in Syria, if you give them a suicide belt and tell them to walk 50 feet to the left and blow up that tomato stand, they're happy to do that. However, that brainwashing is so shallow that if you were to give them an iPhone and a working visa in, let's say, Bulgaria, they'd be delighted to take that over the option of going to heaven via suicide bomb. You know, it's a shallow thing and it's a deep thing.
I really want to know how you are doing 2 years after your release.
Well, thanks for asking. I mean, I feel great. I'm happy to be alive. I could have been dead. And no thanks to my own doing, but just because they spared me and also Qatar intervened on my behalf, I'm free and I can talk to you and ride my bike around Paris. It's better than the alternative.
The fact that Qatar intervened and not the United States, would you have liked a different outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the United States' view at the time was that al-Qaeda was beyond the pale. In the same way that they view Bashar al-Assad as somebody who's just, you cannot negotiate with him because he's so evil, this is what they thought of al-Qaeda, and therefore they couldn't come and, like, horse trade for me, which I understand. I put myself in danger and jeopardy, but after 2 years, I hoped that they would pick up the phone and you know, I think Qatar was more engaged and more determined to get me out than the U.S. was. Not that I don't love my government. They were brilliant when I finally came home. I mean, they're great. I still like them, but I don't think they did much when I was away.
Are you still in touch with any of the people who held you captive?
Yes. I'm curious what they're up to. How you doing? What's going on? What's the weather like?
Really?
No, I'm interested. Listen, they still have hostages of not American hostages, as far as I know, but they have Western hostages. And I'd like to help the families of those people recover their loved ones.
So these are high-ranking and low-ranking al-Nusra members that you're in touch with?
I can talk to all levels of al-Qaeda in Syria if I want to. We lost Kayla Mueller. We lost Peter Kasig. We lost Steve Sotloff and James Foley. Because we refuse to pick up the telephone, and they're also horse traders, these guys. They want to swap, and they need things, so we should have thrown them some things and see what happened, but we didn't.
Do you feel like you understand their psyche?
Every day for 2 years, I had to negotiate for, can I go to the bathroom? Can you open the window a little bit for me? You know, after 2 years, you learn, like, how to ask questions. You learn which guys are important. Don't waste your time with him. Go to the other guy. So if any government out there with a captive is listening, please call me up.
I hear that when you were being held captive, you used to sing the Eagle song, Desperado, to your captors. Is that true?
I sang many songs to them. I heard this beautiful folk singer on your program, The World, right?
Yeah.
The World. Her name is Elizabeth Ayoub. She sings in Arabic.
Oh, Elizabeth Ayoub. She's fantastic.
You know her?
Yeah.
Well, she sings this song about missing her mom. And I used to sing this to this one guy in Deir ez-Zor.
In Arabic?
In Arabic, yeah. She sings a beautiful song. So I used to sing to this one guy in Deir ez-Zor. I'm sure he missed his mom too. I would sing it like once a day. And one day I didn't sing it. And at the end of the day, we weren't allowed to talk in this prison at all. But he whispered to me from like three cells away. He goes, "Hey, my friend, you didn't sing today. What happened?" And it was the first like communication I had had in weeks from any one of my fellow prisoners. And suddenly I'm like, oh, they like my singing. I got to sing for them more. So I started singing the Eagles, you know. I sang like the Beatles. I sang Day by Day. You know, I sang like anything I could think of. And when I was in the shower, I sang. I don't know. I thought it was kind of funny because you weren't allowed to talk, and you certainly weren't allowed to. They weren't allowed to sing because music is forbidden in Al Qaeda land. However, I was Christian, and I could kind of say, "Well, this is like a religious song, man. It's a Christian religious song. You guys sing your religious songs all the time. Well, I can. Can I do mine?"
And they bought that.
You know, it depended on the guard, but some of them were like, "Well, go ahead, do what you want." Some were like, no, forbidden.
Incredible. Theo Padnos is the author of Undercover Muslim, A Journey into Yemen. He was held captive by the al-Nusra Front in Syria for almost 2 years until he was released in 2014. Theo, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's go out today with the song Theo Padnos mentioned earlier, Lesh, or Why. He sent us this version of the song by Elizabeth Ayub, that singer-songwriter from Venezuela. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.